Danny Chalette is my guest this week in the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Danny is originally from Pennsylvania, and we find out why Danny, who has been living in Canterbury for the last 20 or so years, doesn't consider herself to be culturally American anymore. We find out that she originally wanted to be a lawyer. We find out why her father, who was a lawyer, advised her not to follow that path and why. Danny talks about her background in martial arts and walking through creeks and lakes in order to catch snakes with her father. That's the only time so far in the interviews when someone has told me that they have a background in handling snakes. And the time that she accidentally killed her father's snakes. Danny also explains how she no longer has a fear of animals. We learn how Indiana Jones was Danny's hero. Musically, we learn about her passions and how she got into alternative rock, for example, the music of Tori Amos. We find out how Danny ended up in Canterbury following some difficult personal circumstances, why it was that she wanted to stay, and how it was a more advantageous and accepting environment, and she was accepted for being the person that she was. She talks about her inspirations in her undergraduate days, how she used to do a lot of travelling by herself, and how she has kept in touch with people from those days. We also find out about the kendo, which she started doing in 2002. Danny talks about her voting history and the use of social media in finding out what is happening in the news. We talk about what chimes with our friends on Facebook and about the role of the media in shaping us. Danny talks about when she was in a double-page spread back in the 1980s in her local newspaper when she was in a karate competition, and we find out why her memories are not always predominantly positive and whether it is possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. We find out that Danny wanted to be an astronaut and why she wasn't able to follow that path and why she loves to learn and to teach. Danny talks about the research she is carrying out, including a paper she's working on mythology and video games, and about her PhD on science, religion, and popular culture. It was fantastic to catch up with Danny Chalette for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is an absolute pleasure to have Danny Chalette, or should I say Dr. Danny Chalette. I think I had a slight little bit of a role to play.
A little bit, in that. Just a teeny bit there. I mean, you were my supervisor, and I was not the easiest student. So, yeah, a little bit of a role.
Okay, well, we'll talk about your trajectory in a moment, got to where you are and what you've done since. But tell us a bit about yourself, because I know, although you've been in Canterbury for many, many years, that's not where you hail from.
No, I hail from originally Pennsylvania. I would say Philadelphia, not necessarily from Philadelphia, but I'd like to tell people that because they won't know where I'm from. I was from kind of out in the middle of nowhere and lived on a lake. Not directly on a lake, but, you know, the side of a lake. In Marsh Creek.
And in terms of identity, do you sometimes have to think about the answer to the question, you know, where are you from? Because you've been, I'm guessing, you've been in Kent most of your life.
I have, actually. I've spent more of my life here now than I have in the States. So I don't really consider myself, I shouldn't really say this, but I don't really consider myself culturally American anymore because I don't even know what that culture is. And I know some of my American friends and family would probably be very disappointed in me to say that. But
I always find it funny, though, because I've got family who have always lived in Cardiff. In fact, they've never moved, really. And I see them, you know, maybe once every few years. But I think when I went to university, I suddenly, at the age of 18, met people from so many different backgrounds, from many different cultures, nationalities, and still in touch with them. That I don't think it's strange at all that I don't live in the place where I grew up.
Yeah.
But if you'd said to me, you know, 30 years ago when I was still at school, you know, where do you think you're going to end up? You know, or somebody said, you know, do you think you might like be living in Canterbury? I'd say that's absurd. Of course not. What would I be doing in Canterbury? I have no base there. So in a funny way, I suppose my answer is very similar to yours. I spent most of my life away from the place from where I hail. When I go back there, it's sort of familiar and strange at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been back to the States About 8 years, and last time I did go back, and I hope my family doesn't listen to this, I didn't let them know, because we went to Disney. And as much as I love my family, I know they would try to make an effort to come and see me, and I think that myself and my partner just wanted to go there and just have some time to ourselves.
It's often funny, though, when you've got children, because... We live in a very global world where obviously we're exposed to different accents and to different all sorts of different ethnicities and nationalities and so on, and yet it's quite funny when my own children have, and they're very young, but you can sort of hear traces of a Kent accent, which
that's
of course
funny, yeah.
is simply because of where they happen to live. And yet I don't, well, people say to me I don't sound as though I'm from South Wales. So it's sort of funny that I've somehow escaped an accent, and yet my own children have one, but it's an accent that they've got kind of because of me, because that's where I've landed.
I know, yeah.
Because of a job.
It's really funny. It's like mine, a little boy as well, is obviously he has a mother who's American and a father who's English, but he's picking up a proper little English accent now. Mummy, that type of thing, that mummy or daddy.
But you'd always assume, wouldn't you, that you probably would have, just before you had children, you probably thought that, they would just talk like you with an American accent.
Because
you think,
well,
I'm the mother, therefore
exactly.
That's what they're exposed to. But
exactly.
Of course, I know somebody once who whose daughter had this Liverpudlian accent, and she'd never been anywhere near Liverpool. I was like, well, this is a bit weird. Like, why does your daughter have a Mersey accent? She said, oh, the babysitter's from Liverpool. And I thought, isn't that interesting? And I thought, I don't know, what to read into that. But does that mean that the child spends more time with the babysitter than the mother? I thought, maybe I won't. We won't press on that one.
But
tell me a bit. So Pennsylvania is where you're from.
Yes.
What about sort of background? Your parents? What did they do?
Oh gosh. Well, my mother was a clinical psychologist. That's probably why I'm really immensely messed up, because I was like her guinea pig, and she had a doctorate in psychology. And my father was a lawyer, and he was a lawyer for Hertz Penske. So, I was very lucky. I had a relatively influential, affluent background, and here I am now, a poor academic-ish person. So. Yeah,
but we all have to make choices. This is the hard thing, because some people, I don't know, I remember I was in hospital, nothing serious, but I was in hospital in my first term when I was at university, when I was back in Cardiff, and there was a chap on the bed sort of opposite from me who struck up a conversation, and he asked what I do, and I said, oh, I'm at university. And that was quite alien to him, because he was the same age as me, but he'd been working for like 3 years at that point. And he was earning money, and he was talking about getting promotion or running his own,
business,
car mechanic, he was going to own his own car business. So for him, it was rather strange that I would go somewhere where I have to effectively pay to be a student, although I suppose we got a grant in those days. But it was really interesting, because at the time I couldn't have gone into the world of work at that age, because I, lacked those sort of skills. I guess if I'm looking back, maybe I should have got a job at the age of, as some of my friends at school did at 14 or 15, who might have worked in department stores or record shops, that sort of thing. But I didn't do any of that, so I've only ever worked in academia. It's what you make of it, and there's a quality of life involved in that, and plenty of people who make lots of money who are like, oh, I can't wait to retire, I've had enough, I'm burnt out.
Well, this is what my father said, because I really wanted to be a lawyer like him. And I mean, he worked, because he was doing really well. He worked, he was always working, and he was always away on business trips and all sorts of things. And when I was considering this, one day he turned around to me and said, I don't want you to become a lawyer. He said, I think you make a good lawyer, but I don't want you to become a lawyer. And I was like, well, why not? He's like, because I have never have any time for my family. And he said, and it was really my dad that pushed me in the direction. He said, do something you want to do, because at the end of the day, you can make all the money in the world, but what's more important is that you enjoy your life and that you have time with your family. And I think that's something I really took away with me after he said it. So.
Yeah, I think it matters a lot, because it's easy to follow somebody else's dream.
And it is.
And that's the problem. And my parents have always been more than 100% supportive of everything I've done. And I know they're really proud, because in a way, my sister and I followed a very different path to them. So it's not as though they said, oh, you must do this. Or they didn't sort of encourage me to follow a particular career path. But it's what you make of it. But sometimes when you do something that's completely different to what your parents might have anticipated, it's like, well, actually, you've done that on your own. That's
it's
like,
true,
that's
yeah.
your
yeah.
journey rather than living somebody else's dream. Because that, yeah. the problem with that is that effectively it's like somebody else's frustrations or, you know, whatever it is that, you know, maybe the job that, or, you know, if you do better than your parents, and, you know, it's sort of like, it's like you're living out their
dreams,
perhaps,
yeah, no, that's
and,
the thing.
And, you know, the potential for jealousy in that yeah. sort of thing, I don't know. It's yeah, I think sometimes if you don't do what you think is the right thing for you, then, you know, there's going to come a point when you sort of just feel, I can't do this. I cannot
yeah.
go into this place of work. It's yeah. not me. I don't feel, well, I'm expressing myself.
Mm.
It's like somebody else's life that I'm channeling.
Yeah.
What about things that you remember, though, doing? And, well, I guess either... But you came to Kent, what, in my early 90s, was it? Or?
No, late 90s.
Late 90s.
I'm a bit younger than you, Chris.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I forgot. Sorry. Well,
it's okay.
Eternally 40. Well, I'm 46, yes. But what about things that you remember doing when you were young? What sort of your childhood
memories? Well, I did a lot of martial arts. I started martial arts at the age of 5. My mother wanted me to do ballet, but my father said, I'll let her do what she wants. And I went into karate, and I did that for years and years and years. And I was actually I haven't really told anyone this, apart from maybe my partner, but I was going to go into the Junior Olympics, actually, in martial arts and taekwondo. I was that good, and I was there like 5 days a week, always working up until... stuff happened with my family and stuff. My parents got a divorce and I went downhill. And I wasn't able really to pursue that. So I kind of focused a little bit more on academia and stuff. But I also remember as a kid, especially with my dad, I have a lot of fond memories of my dad, like doing, he was really keen. He loved his snakes. And we used to go walking through like creeks and stuff and
like real
yeah,
snakes
yeah
like,
and he
like
would catch snakes,
jungle snakes,
yeah, they weren't jungle snakes, they were like water snakes, but
okay.
close, but yeah, he would catch them and I would go with him and it was lots of fun and we would spend hours just walking through streams and creeks and while he caught them and tadpoles and all sorts of things. It was really cool and he was bitten a couple of times and I remember him because he just loved them. But I also killed my father's snakes accidentally as well when I was young. Because I didn't like the fact at that time you could feed them like live mice. And my father, I told him this when I was 18 because he wondered why his snakes had died. And really what had happened is they starved to death because I would save the mice and let them go in the garden. But yeah, I had a really fond memory of like doing lots of cool stuff like that. Martial arts, ice skating, all sorts of things. I was quite an active hiking, let's say, when I was little, quite active and very outdoorsy.
But has that... So in terms of like now, because I've got this, and I don't know whether I was, I must have been stung by a wasp when I was very young, because I've got this, I mean, it's not unusual, but I've got this sort of wasp sort of paranoia. But in terms of snakes, I mean, that would really freak me out. I mean, there aren't that many snakes, I hope, in East Kent. How do you find, I mean, do you find then, did that give you lots of like resilience?
Yeah, I think I don't have any issues with snakes. I wouldn't mind having pet snakes myself, but, and you know, I know how to care for them and stuff, and I really like them. They're quite nice creatures. But it's also given me a good indication of, you know, I know the differences between poisonous snakes and snake habitats and stuff like that. So I think I've learned a lot about how to avoid potential deadly snake. Here you don't have to worry about it much because you just have adders, don't you? But in the States you'd have things like rattlesnakes and I mean, even water snakes really have a nasty, nasty bite. But in the States you've had like water moccasins and rattlesnakes and a couple of other nasty, nasty snakes there. So.
No, because I know some people who said that they would really struggle going to Australia because of what they might find. But of course, I rather naively once said, yeah, but I used to watch Neighbours and I never saw any sort of great, horrible, frightening spiders or anything. It's like, yeah, well, that's really, that doesn't mean it's necessarily representative. But I just think it's just like us. We all live the same sort of lives. It's a, you know, how can, you know, it's just like having these massive creatures suddenly appearing in our sort of toilet bowl. I was like, it doesn't happen over here.
And
so
there's like brown recluses are really poisonous, aren't they? The kind of was it Australia where they are from and but I think the whole thing with having a dad like that was I just really got into animals at an early age and I don't have many fears of animals. I did have fear of dogs for a time, but that was only because when I was about 7 years old, I was playing on my swing set, and there were two really nasty, a Doberman Pinscher and a Rottweiler, that came out and tried to eat me. Yeah. It was terrifying. And the only way I got around them was to climb on a swing set. So I had a fear of dogs for a little bit of time, but I'm over that now. Yeah. But other animals, no, I'm not. I don't have any real fears of animals.
Yeah. Well, what about other things? I mean, Tim, because obviously you're a huge movie
fan. Gosh.
I'm sure we'll get onto that. But do you have any particular early memories? I'm guessing things like The Breakfast Club or...
Indiana Jones,
of course. Hence the archaeologist.
I just wanted to be an archaeologist, but my parents said that was a career I just couldn't do because I wouldn't make any money. But here I am, right? Yeah. Archaeologist. I loved Indiana Jones. Yeah. Loved it. Star Wars and Indiana Jones, my favourites.
It's funny what sort of influences, you know, I suppose it's the sort of the whole role model thing that films can sometimes do. I mean, sometimes they can give us these sort of imperfect notions of, you know, the happy ever after syndrome. But a lot of people, Jessica Frazier, who used to work here, was always the same. But, you know, sort of Indiana Jones was this real, like, you know, almost still striving to sort of
be that
to
person.
Be that. And why not? Yeah.
You know, I would love to be able to, you know, have my fedora. I even like to wear fedoras, and I think that's because of Indiana Jones. But yeah, he's my hero. Yeah. My hero for a long time. Yeah.
What about musically? What was going on when you were growing up? Can you remember?
I was actually talking to a kid about this. Can I remember? Not like you. You've got like this weird memory for addictive memory for such things.
Well, I think I know what was number one when you were born.
I know it was number one when I was born as well.
Greece, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was. Which song from Greece?
Either Greece. Summer Lovin' or You're That's the One That I Want.
I can't remember which one it was. Yeah. One of those. But I do remember that because I remember those cards. It was like, this was the top of the charts when you were born. Yeah. But thank you for giving away my age, Chris. I appreciate that. Jesus. Now anyone who looks that up will be able to tell when I was born. But, God, I was talking to my friend about this. They were talking about New Kids on the Block. They were quite popular.
My Nemesis, I think. I don't know why. That it was when they came out very end of 89.
Yeah.
Over here, they had two number ones. I know Hanging and Tough.
Something about love. Something about love.
And suddenly I just heard this, and it was just as the 80s turned into the 90s. I just thought, I don't connect with this at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, I sort of got through all the other sort of, you know, the great, there was the Duran Duran, there was Bros and lots
Rush.
Of these sort of, yeah, oh, well, yeah, gosh, that may have...
Chicago?
Yeah, wow, because...
Chicago's really popular.
But they're really good stuff. I mean, like the boy bands, the sort of where, you know, all the sort of 14, 15-year-olds were into that, and then they move on to something else. But New Kids on the Block, suddenly there was just something in that I just thought, this isn't me.
Yeah.
And I wonder, it's almost that loss of innocence, because suddenly, you know, my life was always sort of like Sundays right down the charts. I was like really excited, then I just didn't care anymore.
Yeah.
But what was interesting is it wasn't that I suddenly like stopped being interested in the charts. It was just that I wasn't so much interested in new charts, but all the older ones, you know, the ones that I grew up with, even to this day, completely have this hold over me.
Yeah.
So was it similar, that sort of thing similar with you?
It was in a way, but it wasn't until like the 90s when I really started getting into it, because I became really into alternative rock, because I was into things like Nirvana. And then I love Tori Amos, and I did, Tori Amos was my hero. And Alanis Morissette, I remember actually going to see them in concert in like 1998 or 99. I saw them both in concert, and that was awesome. But, you know, because I got to that kind of teenage angsty, and that kind of music really appealed to me. Yeah. But I think I was never really into New Kids on the Block either. Because it wasn't until like the 90s where I found my true love was things like real alternative rock, you know, like Soundgarden and Nirvana, Tori Amos, things like, I don't know if you've gone a lot here, like, you know, Indigo Girls and stuff like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Four Non-Blondes, that type of thing. So that's kind of the era I remember. And like Natalie Imbruglia and stuff like that, you know, with Torn and things like that.
Absolutely.
So that's when I started coming into my love for music.
And no, she had another big hit some years later, which I thought was as probably better than Torn.
But
it was a one-word answer. But everyone was like, oh, it's not as good as, like, I can't get that. So Torn was sort of 97.
Yes,
and then she had,
I can't remember what it was.
Oh, in about sort of 2005, she came back with another hit, which is also interesting because it's the sort of like people grow up with a particular artist. The artist kind of disappears a little bit for a few years.
And then,
but I'm always into that whole sort of like, you know, when somebody associated with your childhood, so they go away for a little bit, but they, come back.
Yeah.
And I sort of want, you know, I almost sort of like feel I want to say, well, well done.
For, yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
You know, you're still on the circuit. You sort of, you know, this is still something that drives you.
Yeah.
So what about how you ended up coming to Canterbury? What was that all about?
I lost my mother when I was quite young, so I lost my mother about 17, and I went a little bit off the rails because I was young and it was a really stressful time. And I think at the end of the day, I just really wanted to get away from home. Not saying I didn't have the support there, but I just was really rebellious and I needed to find my feet. And I really wanted to run away in many respects. An opportunity came up at my university that I could do an exchange program. So I did an exchange program, got really good grades, got like, I think my GPA was something like around like 3.89, when, you know, you take into effect that the highest you can get is like 4.0 in America. So that is a pretty damn high thing, because in order to come to England, you needed to have like a 3.5 GPA. So I worked my ass off, I can say that right. I worked my ass off to get here. And then I decided that I wanted to stay because I met all my friends and I just liked kind of having my own life, I think. And it was hard because my family wouldn't accept the fact I wanted to stay here. But when I didn't come home, they eventually kind of accepted that that was the way it would be. And that's why I'm here, to be honest.
So you found, I suppose maybe because you chose it as well.
Also, I was kind of really alternative. So it wasn't, not only was I like, and I didn't know it at the time, but not only was I kind of, you know, part of LGBT, being, you know, bi, because that's something that I didn't realize when I was younger. But I was also really into Wicca and all sorts of alternative things. And America just was not the place that accepted that type of thing. Yeah. So when I came here, I kind of found my people and people who understood me and people who didn't judge me.
Yeah.
And that's kind of why I stayed. Whereas in America was so conservative, it was really difficult to kind of, I mean, I lost friends when they found out that I was like, when I was doing Wicca and stuff, and people were like, oh, you're doing black magic. It's like, no, but okay. You know, that type of thing. And I think that it was just not a place that I could grow and be myself. So I had to find a place where I could do that.
Yeah, and a few other people I've interviewed here have said the same thing, that they journeyed from America here and then thought, no, this is where I
this
feel
is where
more,
you belong.
This is my spiritual home, and I belong here. But when I was at university, there was a place called, it was in the Student Union Bar, Goth's Corner. And in a way, it was kind of like, almost like that refuge. It's like people who were a little bit more alternative than perhaps than their families might have wanted. But of course, there was always that dilemma, because at the end of the degree, what do they do? Do they go back and return to living with their parents again?
Yeah, that's the thing.
Having found this freedom, and some people, you know, got away, and others didn't quite so much. Some people, you know, led a more conventional life. Perhaps, you know, they had, you know, university was a great, was like release valve, and then they kind of returned to perhaps what they were expected to do. They conformed all over again.
Yeah, I can't say I've ever conformed. And I think that my dad was really supportive, because I lost my dad as well when I was 26, but he was really supportive of me doing, because he was the kind of person who's like, just do, you know, you'll do well, whatever you do, just follow your dreams. And he was really, really supportive of me. My uncle, on the other hand, wasn't as supportive, but he's more supportive now as he's getting older, and we've kind of seen eye to eye. Because my uncle kind of became, when my father died, my uncle became my, basically our guardian, our legal guardian. And he's a good man, And but for a while, we didn't really see eye to eye at all, because we were quite. I think we're a lot more similar than we thought we were. Yeah. And now that we've gotten, you know, we've kind of related a bit more. But at the time, we couldn't see. It was hard staying here, but I decided this is the place I need to be if I'm actually going to grow.
And also, I think stepping away from that environment as well.
I needed it,
and you do find that sometimes, because we all find, I mean, I certainly can see huge traits. You know, I'm just like my parents. I'm like 50-50. I can see both physically and in terms of the way that I tick. And yet sometimes, but because I live away from my parents, I mean, I see them sometimes a few times a year, but when I speak to them regularly, but when I do see them, I can really see where I get all my sort of traits from. But
yeah.
I think it's that, but at the same time, it's like, but this is my life and I could never go back to that. So it makes me appreciate them and everything they've ever done so much more, because it's almost like, you know, I wouldn't be who I am, you know, I am who I am because of them, but also I haven't followed an identikit path. So it sounds like you've probably got family. You're very, very close to them, or very similar to them, but you also perhaps needed to actually assert your own identity.
My own identity, and that was the issue, because, you know, with losing mom and at an early age and stuff, identity was an issue. So I needed to find who I was, and I needed to be with people that would accept me for who I am, and that just was not happening back home.
Yeah. And when you came here then as an undergraduate, were there particular sort of teachers who inspired you? I mean, what was sort of like going on? What was it that made you think, actually, this is... But obviously you stayed in the academic system, but what was sort of the real sort of galvanising
thing? The thing was the people I met, because I met some really good friends, and a lot of those people are still my friends today. I mean, you and I have been friends for about 10 years, and a lot of my other friends, you know, I've been friends for, the people who are closest to, some of them 20 years. And it was really my friends that kept me here. I would like to say that I had people that... I've never been the type of person that really had... I mean, I did admire people, but I never had, like... a person I wanted to be like, you know. It's never been like that with me, you know. So there were teachers that I liked, but they weren't really the people that drove me. It was my friends, because, you know, and my friends' families, because I was so far away from home. It was my friends' families that kind of, and my friends that opened their houses up to me.
So you were very much adopted, really.
And even now, you know, I've got some really close friends who I've been adopted by, you know, and basically consider me part of the family. So I think that's what keeps me here.
Yeah. So you've clearly sort of made your own mark here over the years.
Well, I would have liked to have made more of a mark, but yeah, I think I have.
Yeah. But what also stands out, like you mentioned a lot of sort of musical influences, but how would you sort of sum up your undergraduate days, particularly? What sort of structures were there? What did you listen to? What did you watch? What were the sort of, and I guess also being in the same place, and it's sort of changed over the years, but sort of where did you go, and what sort of structures were in place in those days?
Well, I would say that my undergraduate days, I didn't work as hard as I could have done, because I was always the type of person that could just you're like this as well, the type of person that could just cruise to not have to worry. So to be fair, I wish I had worked a lot harder. You know, I did a lot of drinking and a lot of partying. But what I also really like to do is I really like to go around.
Because that all stopped, of course, when I became your supervisor.
It all did. Actually, it stopped when I, it actually stopped when I was about 23, 24, because I got to the point where I was just like, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, it's too tiring. And, you know, there was the gym as well. So I was at the gym all the time. Yeah. So I had that thing going, and I had my kendo and my martial arts. Mm. And as far as academia is concerned, I just started going, well, I'm really into this. And because I worked up in university and I did a lot of note taking for students at the time, it was really, you know, I kind of wanted to move towards becoming more of a polymath. So I went into different classes and studied different things and did stuff. And here I find myself there. And not only that, though, but also, I wanted to get, because I didn't know how long I was going to be here at the time, so I wanted to get all around, moving around England and visiting, like, castles and all sorts of things. So I went to, like, Wales, and because one of my best friends is from Pentwyn?
Mm.
Yeah? Did I say that right?
I always saw it as Pentwyn, but Pentwyn.
Well, that's Pentwyn. Okay, well, you're Welsh, so you would know better than
I. But I don't know, but that doesn't say we say it correct.
Yeah, she's from around there. And then, you know, I went up to Scotland and went to loads of castles up there. I did a lot of travelling by myself when I was here to kind of find my feet.
But in that sense, you probably would have done a lot more than somebody like myself would have done, because you think, oh, I'm from this part of the world, I can go anytime, rather than I have to do it in the next month or the next year. But that's what I find quite exciting sometimes, that, you know, I mean, my own students sometimes probably know, or I get to know more about my colleagues through my students, because they will sometimes tell me what they think about other lectures. You mentioned, you know, being a polymath, but, you know, you'd sit in on classes, people from different disciplines. I mean, you seem to know everybody in the university. You know people from sciences.
Been here for a long time,
you know, you've really networked in that sense. You just know people because you've been around so long, and you've got friends from every kind of like corner of the university. Whereas I don't know them, but often my students will talk about this person does this and that, and I think, oh really? I think, you know, this is one of my work colleagues, but I don't know that much about them because I don't sit in on their lectures, yeah. But my students do. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, you've probably got a really good sense of the way that the university as a whole is sort of put together.
I did. I don't know about it now. I guess I kind of still do because I've got friends within the university, but yeah. But yeah, that was it. You know, it was just lots of studying, lots of traveling, just tried to make the most of being here.
And did you sort of make a record of all of that in the form of, I don't know, diaries or photographs from the period?
Do you know, I wish I had, but at the time, you know, our phones were really shit. You know, like we're talking about the early 90s, noughties, so we didn't have the kind of phones we had. I mean, we have, there's a number of pictures that a lot of my friends took. But I think, most of it is just done in memories and getting together with friends and talking about it, as you know, the whole nostalgia thing and getting back to... And I keep in contact with the people I hung around with when I was younger. So, you know, we still talk.
In a way, that probably is sufficient. It's just that sometimes I took photographs, not a huge number, and I had very sort of quite piecemeal diary entries. I kind of regret that because there are particular memories I have which I can't completely isolate, or sometimes I know that that was on my first year, but I couldn't tell you necessarily when. And I've tried to sort of go back, and sometimes, though, a bit like a plain detective, I've sometimes found that I can remember particular things that were on the radio, and I have been able, often through external, because you're finding the time to do this, but sometimes go back through old radio times type schedules, and I have sometimes been able to say, okay, I've worked out that I remember
what year that is.
I went to see Kirsty MacColl in concert. That was wow. Especially, obviously, she died very young, you know, some years later. And to have seen Kirsty MacColl when I was at university, it was the summer ball in my first year, but couldn't work out when it was. But I did manage to narrow it down. And then some years later, after I'd narrowed it down to one of two Fridays, and I think I pretty was sure which of the two it was, I then thought one day, why don't I just go into Google? I tapped in Kirsty MacColl, Lampeter, 1992.
And you found it.
And I found it, because there was a very old concert schedule from when she was on tour. Yeah. So again, but also that, so in a way, but I'd already worked out when it was, and I was quite proud of myself that it sort of fitted.
Cool, yeah.
And I thought, I've somehow managed to just about, I can kind of account for, not all, but many of the things that I did and the people I knew and the lifestyle, you know, that I had back then. But sports was obviously a big thing for you. You mentioned Cambridge.
Oh, yeah. I would say that martial arts primarily was a big thing. Although I did do, in high school, I did a lot of softball. And I was okay at it. But I wanted to focus more on martial arts. And I started kendo in about 2002.
Yeah.
And did that for a while.
And to what sort of level? Because I know you do that.
Well, I don't really want to grade in it, so because, you know, with something like kendo, it's all about kind of, you know, you can tell someone's grade by how good they are. And I thought, well, I don't really want to grade it. I got kind of sick of getting graded because I've got a third dan in taekwondo and karate. So it was just like, and for those that don't know, you know, like as in third degree black belt. So, you know, it was just that kind of like, I just want to do something where I'm not having to focus on getting getting a rank. But now that I'm older and I want to teach it and I want to go back into it and actually start to get ranks in it so I can effectively teach the martial art, but that would be the only reason to do it, to be honest.
So the snakes are probably frightened of you now that we're not going anywhere near.
Yeah, you know, I can just hit him with big sticks. Big sticks.
Yeah, like Stephen Seagal or something.
I haven't done kendo in a while since I had the baby, so
And also because, obviously, you're American. What about things like voting? I'm guessing because you do. Can you vote in
America? You can.
You can vote in America, but not here, is
no,
that right?
I can, but you have to put in in a ballot.
A postal
ballot. Yeah, and to be honest, I don't want to talk about my voting history. It's not the best. I didn't vote for Trump.
No.
I didn't do that. But yeah, and unfortunately, well, to be honest, not unfortunately for the last election, because let's face it, the delegates were shocking. I mean, Hillary wasn't much better than, well, she was better than Trump in some ways, but come on, let's face it.
And she got 2 million more votes, of course.
But
the electoral system is configured in such a way that that wasn't what,
But, I didn't vote in the last election. Yeah. I was too late getting my ballot in. But yeah, we can vote. but you need to get, I mean, it needs to be months in advance as well.
Yeah.
So if you miss the deadline, you miss the deadline.
Yeah.
And because it's kind of constituencies, you know, you need to get, need to find out when the ballot, the postal ballot is due in for your state and so on and so forth. So,
but it must be funny as well, because you're voting in an American election, but people are following it no less assiduously over here.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly, I mean, I remember when the result came through of the 2016 presidential election,
and one
of my students, I was quite, you know, concerned about the result, and I said, "Gosh, so you know, when did you find out? Because I didn't see it coming." And she said, "Oh, I saw it on Facebook." And I thought, "What?"
You know,
I thought,
thing,
and of course,
yeah.
Now I get that now, but at the time I wasn't on Facebook. But I thought, you know, I thought, "What do you mean you weren't watching BBC News?"
Yeah,
you know?
No, it's true.
It's interesting, but you know, but that's it. But people, but also it means that people have taken a greater interest, because it's, you know, if you use social media, it appears on your social media.
But this is
15 years ago. It was like, how do we get people to be engaged in politics?
Well, you know, 18 years ago, how did you get people to meet up on time? You know, you just did.
Yeah,
and now it's just like an absolute fuss. But you're right. I mean, do you remember in 2015 there was that earthquake? The only way I found out, because I remember being, it has nothing to do with postal voting, but I remember being in bed and hearing like this roar, like, I was like, what the hell was that? And then I felt my body moving in a really weird way, and I just went on Facebook, and then I just saw, everyone was like, that was an earthquake. I was like, oh, so it was an earthquake, that makes sense now. But that was my first port of call, was social media, was Facebook for that news, 2015.
And but the way that news, I mean, the you know, news was very top down. I remember it was good in terms of structure, so I kind of miss it a little bit. But when I was, you know, in school, certainly sixth form, watching the 6 o'clock news, I mean, there was teletext in those days, so you could find out what was happening.
Yeah.
But you know, with my dad, often 6 o'clock, either before or after tea, I can't remember, we would sit and watch. And it was all very formal. It was the 6 o'clock news from the BBC.
Yeah,
Peter Sissons and Moira Stewart, whatever. And it was but the way it was done, but it was the structure, you know, and you knew what would happen.
Yeah.
You'd have like the five headlines at the beginning, and that was kind of the way we got our information. But now, of course, you can be selective. So sometimes, you know, I will always gravitate towards, I don't know, politics stories, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But in that sense, but it also means I'm very selective in what I find out. And actually, I missed, you know, when, because you had, I was actually away and I had only partial access to the internet in 2005, it would have been, on the day that London was successful in the Olympic bid.
Oh, right.
That
was
an amazing story.
Yeah.
But I found that out because somebody told me, because I, you know, perhaps I had to go to an internet cafe, because I didn't have it on my, you know, phone in those days. And even when Michael Jackson died some years later, I found out because somebody told me, because I didn't have access to the internet in, I think I was in Germany at the time. How different now when I'm, you know, following it all the time, I get all these updates wherever I am in the world. But also, the next day we had the London bombings.
Oh, God, of course. Because that was July 7th, wasn't it?
That's absolutely right. And I was away that week. And again, that all sort of passed me by. I think people heard it. And I think I think what had happened then, I'd simply gone on. It was before, obviously, this was like the top story. But I think that morning I remember sort of thinking, what's good? But there was similar to the one we got now, but there was a Conservative leadership election thing. I remember following that. But again, I probably had gone into a particular sort to, you know, see what's happening. But I missed the wider picture. So that is sometimes the issue, that sometimes you can, the news is something that you can just sort of engage with what you want to. And you can have all these very sort of deep and sometimes quite fractious discussions on social media with other people, but it's kind of very niche.
And then you get that echo chamber effect as well, don't you?
Yeah.
Which is problematic, because you get idiots saying what they want to say and then other idiots agreeing with them.
But also, I find it a great barometer, because I might put up well, and that's a polite way of putting it, but an example would be something I'm like yesterday. It turned out that it was the 20th anniversary. There's a couple of things, 2nd of July, on lots of levels. It was like things that happened on that day in different times in my past. But one of them was getting the PhD 20 years ago. So I put that up, and unexpectedly, I just put up some old pictures. And I was getting like 50 or 60 likes and comments. And I was like, well, you know, I wasn't expecting that. But then I put up something which was a bit more personal, about something to do with my race. radio interest for that particular presenter.
Yes, I saw that.
Put that up, and I didn't get anything on that.
Oh,
and I thought, and again, that was interesting because it just also made me think that just that things that I carry, some of that, you know, are not necessarily
what
well,
other people.
Saying, but it was just interesting as a barometer to say that I'll put something up and that will really chime. But something else that I think is also like really like the most personal post of the day and completely passes people by. So I do find that sort of interaction with the past, but sometimes there'll be this great crossover. But what we all have in common is that maybe we're all in the same place at the same time, and it's that, but we all associate it for different reasons with different things.
But I wonder if it's just we're almost conditioned when we see people's photographs to just like them or, you know, love them, especially if they're our friends.
Yeah.
So I think there's an element of, you know, just habitual kind of liking these things as well. You know, someone sees a photograph, like, someone sees another photo, love, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's the same thing with me. Like, I'll put something personal up and I won't get many responses apart from, you know, a couple of things I put up on mental health because it means a lot to me, mental health. And I got some really wonderful responses. I mean, 90 to 100, you know, actually people getting a hold of me and commenting and stuff like that, which was really nice. But you might put something else up and then get like one or two likes, you know what I mean? Like, oh, today I'm listening to this music, you know, and it's like, yeah. And you know the people that are going to say like because they like that music, you know the people that aren't. And then you put up baby pictures and you get like loads of people.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
Cute. Yeah.
I think it's. But also, I found that reposting, and also it may be the context because when one person responds, other people follow, and I think that's then it, when it appears on people's
feeds.
News feed.
Yeah.
But in terms of more traditional media, what about things like, I mean, radio was utterly part of my sort of my university days, but well, before and after, and still now. But, you know, also coming from America as well, did you find the media very, very different in terms of the way that you'd access information?
Well, it's hard to say, isn't it? Because, you know, to me it wasn't different because I was in America and it was just the thing that was done. You know, we did similar things to what you guys did here was you would have your favorite radio station and you would maybe ring up for requests. I've done it a couple of times. Or you go, okay, here's a show I want to listen to and like, I'm going to record the music and then I'm going to listen to it in my car. You know, so it was that type of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, radio was a big thing, but not so much in terms of disseminating information as much as television was back home. It was more for music and knowing like what's top of the charts and stuff like that.
I saw it as very much more presenter based.
Ours wasn't really presenter based. Or if it was, as a kid, it was something I wasn't interested in. I was more interested in music and top, you know, top music and stuff like that.
But I remember being in America in 2002, honeymoon actually, and I remember switching on breakfast TV and very excited because they said Harrison Ford, I think it was his 60th birthday, and he was going to be their live guest. And I was like really excited about this. Thought, Harrison Ford's going to be on at, you know, 8 a.m. and, you know, Hollywood star is going to be in the breakfast studio. And they kept saying Harrison Ford will be on in a few minutes. I was like really excited. But then they kept going, you know, having the ad. They'd introduce him, then they'd have an advert, and then they'd tell us, you know, he'll be with us. And then he'd be on, and they would ask him some sort of like general questions, nothing particularly challenging. Then they'd have a break, and then the break seemed to be longer than the snippets of the interview they were on. And do you know what? It actually gave me a headache because I was watching that, and I just thought, oh my god, it's almost like my head being filled with bubble gum. Because it was almost as though I thought, I'm really looking forward to this interview, but the interview came in such small segments.
I know what you mean.
I think it's just a matter of adapting. But I kind of thought, you know, it was so different to what I was used to.
Well, it kind of puts me in mind of, like, you know, when you would watch two things, you watch documentaries, and you get this kind of, like, just a recap of what you were just watching, like, 15 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And every time you go to an advert break, you'd get that recap again. And the same with, you know, that clickbait nonsense you get. This article says, and this is what happened. Such and such dug this up. And then there's an advert. Such and such dug this up and this happened. Then there's an advert. Such and such dug this up and this happened and blah, blah, blah. And then it's just like, for goodness sake, I just want to know what this... I'm reading this article because I want to know about this, I don't know, body you found or something, you know, archaeologically. And you're just telling me nonsense. I don't have time for this. But it was a very similar thing. You know, it's just like, here's a little snippet. Here's a break. Here's a little snippet. Oh, it's just a
the one thing I do like now, and this is the good thing about the internet, is that, you know, and it applied to film reviews or politics stories or whatever, is that you can read the same story across different media.
Yes, that's the thing.
And you can do it at the click of a mouse and without
having to
wait. I mean, the days when I'd be on like long train journeys with my parents, yeah. and it'd be a case of we must get the Western Mail, as it were, or one of the papers before we leave, so we can find the latest news. And of course, the papers would have been written, you know, at least 12 hours earlier. Whereas now it's almost gone the other way completely, and because you're getting all the latest updates literally on a live feed situation. Yeah. But that's one of the things I really remember. But also, of course, then because it was a bit more precious. And you choose which paper to read. And of course, sometimes if it was really special, you'd get your scissors out and you'd cut out that article. Mm. You might put it in a scrapbook or on a notice board. And there was something a bit quite special about that. Whereas now it seems a bit more too ephemeral.
Because I was in the paper doing karate, because back in the day when I did it, it must have been 87 or something. Massive spread, double page spread of me kicking someone in the face. When I was little, and one of the reasons for that was, of course, because at the time, you know, a lot of girls didn't do martial arts and weren't, you know, and so I think the journalist really was interested in having a picture of a young girl kind of beating a crap out of this guy, and it was a competition I was in, and that was really nice because that was actually in the Philadelphia Inquirer on the sports page, but a double. And we actually put it in a scrapbook. And I'm trying to dig it up. I can't really find that article. I'd love to see it again. But it's like
But you also know that when you do find that, you'd be really... Because I know, well, if you're like me, I know you'll put that straight onto social media.
I will, and I can't
you know that
it.
Suddenly yeah. everyone's going
to
get really
excited. I don't know
really
where to find it.
That.
I guess I have to look in the archives or something. But it was great because it was this double-page spread. And, you know, at the time I was like, God, 8. So it wasn't a big deal for me. But looking back in it, I mean... It was clearly done. It was done by a woman journalist.
Yeah.
And there was clearly this kind of like underlying message of, look, here's a girl excelling at a boy's sport, and it'd be lovely to bring that back up again. But I can't. I have no idea where.
Do you know, it's actually really funny because I was listening to some old jingles, because obviously I for this very podcast there will be a jingle introducing you and then finishing off. And what I found, and it was an old Radio 1 jingle. From 1989, and what in those days, because they weren't 24-hour and they wouldn't start till like about 5 in the morning, and so at 5 to 5 they put on like 5 minutes worth of jingles, which is like, you know, little jingle excerpts from the different presenters. And in those days they only had one female daytime presenter, Jackie Brambles, and she was on at 5 in the morning. So we had all these male presenters and Jackie Brambles, and I listened to this just a couple of days ago. And it was actually shockingly sexist, because it stuck. So it's sort of you had a very sort of butch male voice saying, "She's beautiful. She's
wait for it.
And then it said, "She's a smoking hellcat. She's dynamite." And then the sound of dynamite going off. "She's Jackie Brambles." And I was just thinking, you would never do that now. Although I did think in some alternate reality,
hilarious.
I was thinking, imagine if I appropriated that bit and used it in my jingle.
You should.
So like, for Dan, say, "She's a smoking hellcat. She's dynamite." I mean, you know, it'd be funny.
She beats
also,
a boy.
But also, you know, utterly inappropriate. But at the time, you know, that's... People would have listened to that, and Jackie Brambles probably was aware that she was in a very male environment.
Of course,
but that was just, you know, sort of that was just the
Reminds
way it was
me of
done.
The Anchorman.
Yeah,
that
yeah,
film?
Yeah.
It's a hilarious film. Sorry, it just makes me think about it.
Yeah. My God. Yeah. So you must find out with that piece from the '80s that actually you look back and think, wow, you know, more trailblazing perhaps then than it is now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you didn't have sort of EDI, equality, diversity, inclusivity sort of.
No. And looking back
in
it, that's kind
way.
Of an important thing, and I would love to dig it up and see if I can find it, just to show. Well, look, you know, here's because to her clearly it was a big thing, you know, and it was.
Yeah.
And they might have gone, "Oh, well, she's a cute little 8-year old." But I think it was more the fact, like, because there's a picture of me kicking a boy in the face.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious. So she literally got a picture of me kicking a boy in the face.
And she can handle snakes. All right. So for more philosophically based questions, rather, would you say, Danny, that your memories are predominantly positive ones?
No, I think a lot of them are, but you know, there's some negative ones there because, of course, you know, about my mother and stuff, and that was a really bad time because my mom was sick for a long time. So my memories are more positive now because I had a lot of therapy, but you know, for a while it was not great. But I think predominantly before all this shit happened, I had a really happy childhood, you know, and then when I came to England, things started looking up again, because I had supportive friends and I had supportive family.
But I mean, do you think, though, it's, I mean, this is an odd question in the light of what you just said, but is it possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences?
Because
the reason I say that is because I guess sometimes there are particular challenges which, you know, horrendous at the time, but you say, well, I got through it. So, I mean, in your case, you might, at the time, the most horrible thing, you know, the loss of a parent. But then, I don't know, did it sort of give you some way of like, well, I've dealt with this at this young age. I mean, I'm my parents are still alive. I'm so lucky. But I know that, you know, when that day happens, you know, I'm going to be utterly gutted and there'll be nothing, you know, preparing me for that. And I don't kind of know, because it's sort of, you know, my past, I've got horrible memories of, you know, some experiences in school,
yeah, sort of being
that
yeah.
bit, inverted commas, weird,
a bit
sort of idiosyncratic.
No,
but also sort of like, well, I somehow survived. I somehow got through that. I'm not very nostalgic about my school days, but certainly I am at university, because suddenly it was like, ooh, I've cultivated these skills. I can deal with difficult situations and somehow manage to sort of come through it the other end.
I think it depends upon, you know, the proper answer to that would be it depends upon your mindset, doesn't it? And I think now that I'm in a better mindset, I think, yes, I can see all those things, even though they were negative, they put me in a position, I got through them, but also put me in a position where I feel like I can be more sympathetic to other people who go through things and to be there for other people who go through things. And it's given me that empathy that I don't think I would have unless I had gone through those things. But yeah, it depends. If you had asked me that question 6 months ago, it would have been a completely different story. And yeah. I think this is it. It's just mindset. Being in a bit more of a positive mindset, you go, well, it's in the past, you know, I got through it, that's great, I can help people, you know, I can see how things are going, I can move forward. But yeah, negative mindset, no, absolutely
and,
not.
What about whether you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young? What were your dreams when you were young? I know you mentioned being an archaeologist.
Well, actually, I wanted to be an astronaut. That was really my dream. But I couldn't, because I had really bad eyesight. So I couldn't go into the... I could only be a navigator in the Air Force, so I decided I didn't want to go into the Air Force. But in order in the States for me to actually become a proper astronaut, I would have had to go on through Air Force training and done that. But unfortunately, my eyes stopped me from doing that. But as far as academia is concerned, yeah, I'd like to be making more money, but I like the fact that I'm actually in an academic environment and I love to learn. And I love to teach. So for me, it's the perfect place for me to be.
Yeah.
And I can continue on being that polymath I strive to be, you know. And yeah, so in many ways, yeah, I think I have. I think I achieved so far everything I've really wanted to achieve, which is quite nice. You know, I'd like to be in better state, but financially. But apart from that, if someone were to ask me, do you feel like you've achieved? Yeah, I think, yeah. Life, despite all the crap, life has been all right.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very lucky.
Yeah, and looking back, looking forward, a bit of both, how would you define yourself?
That's a hard question. God, these questions. How on earth do we go from the start of this and then to these really serious questions? Yeah. By the way, he did not prep me for this. I was not expecting this. So...
I asked this in all the interviews.
Do you?
So, yeah.
I don't think you should. It sets people off, especially when you get them talking.
Yeah.
Future. And well, I am involved. I'll be involved in a pretty major project, which will be is actually looking at rewriting the national curriculum. And as my topic, as you know, being my supervisor, was science and religion. I will be helping them out with the religion aspect of that, because basically they're looking for a means to bridge the gap between science and religion and national curriculum. So that's fun and cool, and I should be starting that next month. Currently, I finished writing an article that should be published. Are these the questions you're asking? I guess they are. And I've just started on another article, which I'm just about to finish, on mythology and video games.
And what we didn't talk about, of course, is what you did your PhD on.
I did my PhD on science and religion and popular culture. Because I had a fantastic supervisor. Although that Chris DeCiga is shit, but, you know, No, he's good. He is a great supervisor, actually. I think I was so lucky to have you, actually, as a supervisor. Not that you need me to boost your ego anymore, but you know, you're really good. Excellent supervisor. And I think it helped that you and I really hit it off. And I have to say, I'm liking it now that I got my PhD, because now I can be like your proper friend.
Well,
I'm
not, well,
I have, I have to be friends with your supervisor.
Well, I have to say, well, there's a conversation there, of course, which we'll have off
camera.
But there is, but it, 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 but I did have a very interesting conversation with a colleague about whether it's okay for one's PhD student to ask that, you know, their supervisor to be present at the Viva, and I was present at yours, and you wanted me to be
there.
And my other students have always said that they wanted me to be there, but I was told, well, actually, it's unusual, because I was told that normally what happens is that there might be a, you know, for whatever reason, that the student might sort of feel that they don't want their supervisor there, might maybe put them off. And I was thinking, that's really interesting, because that's not the, you know, so I kind of feel that, you know, I'm doing something right.
Yeah, you
at least
are,
Because I think I'd be quite hurt if they said, actually, I don't want you at the Viva, because you might throw me off balance. I was like, oh. But, you know, well, but thanks. I've been part of this journey right from
it
the outset.
It seems rude, doesn't
so,
it?
And also I feel, well, I'm going to find out anyway what the outcome was. It's better for me to witness that in the sense. And then if there is any more work that's needed, then I sort of, you know, I could pick up from the, you know, the dynamics from the occasion.
Because to be honest, I have to say, if it hadn't been for you, I would not have got my PhD, because, you know, for those listening, there was a lot of shit happening during my PhD, and I had a number of supervisors who weren't great and who were just not on my frame, like, you know, on my wavelength. And when I met you, it just kind of, everything kind of just fell into place. And I think it was also because you let me pursue what I wanted to pursue without being too judgy about it. And you kept me on the straight and narrow, which was just like, you were really good at going, right, I need these words now. I need these words now. I need these words now. And that's kind of what I needed. I didn't need someone going, oh, yeah, give it to me when you're ready, because that would never happen. But yeah.
No, it's funny how that happens, because I had a brilliant supervisor who didn't ask me for work, but I felt an obligation to do it. Yeah. And that was just the way I worked. If I had a supervisor who said, right, I want 3,000 words by next next Friday or something, I'd have thought, oh my gosh, you know, because I would have thought I'd wanted to do that anyway. So it's just funny. So it's like finding, but somebody else had the same supervisor as me and had a different sort of sense, because they thought, well, if I'm not asked to give a certain number of words by a certain deadline, then, well, I might not actually.
It was like that with you and me, wasn't it? And I think that what really helped was that you and I hit it off really well at the start. So we kind of sat down and had discussions about it. And I think you said to me, well, how would you like this run? And I said, well, I just need a supervisor who's supportive, but I also need someone to really kick me up the ass. Which you did. So, and then I got my PhD, which I don't think would have ever happened otherwise. So yeah. I'm very grateful for that.
Wow. Well, do you know, my head is now so big, I don't think I'm going to be able to get
your foot
out of this door. But, so, you know. But Danny, amazing. I would say to catch up, and we catch up regularly, but thank you for sharing your life.
I didn't talk much about my work, though, did I?
Danny, it's been brilliant to catch up. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.